Good morning. The title of my talk today is Extravagant, Outrageous and Undignified. But I'll explain about that a bit later on. To start off, have you ever been around a friend or a member of family who's done something really daft? So daft that everyone is criticising them or laughing at them and having a go. And if so, did you ever end up wanting to stand up for that person, even though you thought they were daft too, just because they're your mate or your brother or your partner, and someone needs to be on their side? Maybe they got drunk and got into trouble, or spent too much money on something that turned out to be a scam or a dud, or made a bad choice of friend or holiday or job or whatever. You just kind of feel you ought to stick up for them so that someone's on their side. If you can relate to that sort of situation, do you think that's what happened at this dinner party we're hearing about at Martha and Mary's house? The one where Mary tips this really expensive perfume over Jesus' feet and wipes it off with her hair. I mean, everyone must have been appalled and whispering about how completely stupid and inappropriate she'd been. So did Jesus stick up for her just to be nice to her? Well, I'm going to look at quite closely at what happened at the dinner party, and then we'll try and decide. First off, though, a little aside about the family. In Jewish culture, Martha and Mary were unusual. Why weren't they married? And why was the house described as Martha's, not Lazarus's? And why is Lazarus never recorded as speaking? In truth, we don't know the answer to any of those questions. But an interesting suggestion made by Jean Varnier is that maybe Lazarus was mentally handicapped. Maybe like our Reuben, talking and thinking weren't his strong hands, and his sisters had been entrusted with looking after him. It's only a suggestion, but it is one that seems to fit, so I thought I'd share it with you. Anyhow, let's move on to the dinner party. Some days or weeks before, Jesus had arrived at Bethany to find the sisters both crying and Lazarus already dead 3 days. Being the Lord of life and death, Jesus promptly raised Lazarus back to life. Not surprisingly, the family now want to formally thank and honour him. There would have been many invited guests, all male, of course, and others would have gathered around outside to watch and try and catch a glimpse of Jesus or Lazarus, both of whom were now local celebrities. True to character, Mary has been busy in the kitchen, and she's now serving the various courses. But Martha is much more focused on Jesus. Last time Jesus came for a meal, she'd sat at his feet, listening to his every word. This time, having had such a personal revelation of Jesus' divinity, for who else but God could raise the dead to life after 3 days in the tomb, Mary wants to worship Jesus, not just listen to him. So, what does she do? Well, Mary has some savings invested in the form of a very, very expensive perfume called nard. Extracted from a plant of the same name, it was imported from India in delicate alabaster bottles. Had Mary been building up her store of nard, little by little? Or had she sold some flocks, maybe, and bought it all in one go? We don't know. But either way, she only goes and pours the whole bottle over Jesus' feet. And we're not talking 50 pounds of perfume here. We're not talking 100 pounds of perfume. I mean, that would be lavish. We're not talking 200 or 500 or even 1,000 pounds worth of perfume, which would have been extravagant beyond reason. There was probably 20 to 25,000 pounds worth of perfume in that bottle in today's money. 25,000 pounds! That's not lavish or generous or extravagant. That's bonkers! At least that's what everyone there would have been thinking. I mean, one drop of nard is enough to fragrance the whole house. Half a dozen drops and the whole street will smell. A dozen and the whole village will pong. So why did Mary tip the whole blooming bottle off on Jesus' feet? Well, slimy and oily as well. Now, John has a bit of a downer on Judas, and you can't blame him given how things work out in the week following this dinner where we get up to Jesus' crucifixion. Now, to be fair, Judas was part of the plan. Jesus did need to be betrayed. It was all prophesied. Anyhow, It seems to me that Jesus only said what everyone else was thinking. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. Judas says this, and everyone must have been thinking and agreeing, because honestly, Mary's really lost it. After all, it wasn't just the stupid waste of money. There was also the fact that what she did was so inappropriate, so embarrassing, so totally not the done thing. The guests must have wondered if she was either drunk or demented. For a start, as you know, it's only men that come to formal dinners. The women are there to serve the food and clear away and organise the servants. They have to stay in the background, that's their place. So Mary, making herself the centre of attention, was really shocking. I bet you could have heard a pin drop when she started pouring that perfume. Every man in the place would have been watching her and wondering what on earth she was doing. Worse again, Mary shockingly unties her hair and lets it fall down around her shoulders. That's something that no decent and respectable woman would ever do in public. Loose hair was a sign of a loose woman, you know. And Mary goes on to touch Jesus' feet. She was wiping them with her hair. Oh my goodness. No woman should ever touch a man she's not related to. What was Mary thinking of? Was she even thinking at all? Certainly, everyone in the room would be shocked. She was basically trashing her own reputation, and she wasn't doing much for Jesus' reputation. Although I think he stayed calm and serene throughout. In fact, I reckon he was definitely the only relaxed person in the room. Everyone else was thinking, like Judas, why wasn't the perfume sold? And what on earth does she think she's doing? How embarrassing. And then Jesus speaks up and defends Mary. Really? What a surprise. Leave her alone, he says. And then he talks about Mary's perfume being linked to the day of his burial. Now we know, and he knew then, that that would come only a week later, but nobody else knew at the dinner. It must have sounded like a really weird comment to make. So, what do you reckon? Was Jesus defending Mary just because everyone else was muttering about her and embarrassed? Or was he pretty shocked at her behaviour too? Was the anointing for burial comment intended to distract everyone? Or did he genuinely approve of what Mary had just done? What do you reckon? He approved. You're right. I think you're right. Because I would say that it's clear, not just from this situation, but from others as well, that Jesus totally approves of Mary's worship. For that was what Mary was doing, worshipping her Lord and God. Mary's worship was extravagant, definitely, outrageous, definitely, and undignified, definitely. And Jesus approved of it. So, this morning I'd like to talk a little bit about worship. It's not something I've really spoken about before, but I think that's what the heart of this story is about. So a few thoughts. Why do we worship God? Well, he is the awesome and holy creator of the universe, above time and space, but also, amazingly, he's the God who is with us, who forgives us, who invites us into his family. So we have that amazing contradiction of beyond us and right here with us, of unknowable and intimate, of demanding perfection and forgiving us time after time. In short, God deserves all our worship. What then matters about our worship? Well, what the Old and the New Testaments make clear is that God is most interested in our heart. Jesus said that we must worship in the spirit and in truth. And in Isaiah, Isaiah says that the one God favours is the ones he looks on with favour are humble and contrite in spirit and tremble at his word. Nothing about what we actually do. So the heart of worship is recognising who God is and putting him at the centre of our lives. What God sees in your worship, I think, is not what you do or say or sing or think, but where you've put him in your life. And I've done some little diagrams, which I hope just make things a bit clearer. For many people, God doesn't feature in their priorities. They can't worship God, give worth to God, worship, because he's got no worth in their lives. For others, God's on the periphery of their life. A nice thing, but certainly not essential. They can worship God a little bit, but not much, because he's not got much worth in their life. And some, by God's grace, for God is at the very centre of their life. He's their priority, and naturally they want to worship him. He has huge worth in their life. As an aside, when I was looking at this, God is a God of transformation, but he is only able to transform, or only chooses to transform, the things we put ahead of him in our lives. Sorry, we put him ahead of in our lives. It's like his transformation goes outwards. With God at the edge of my life, his blessings are going outside my life. If God is in my life, next slide, then his blessings reach into my life. If God is at the centre of my life, right in the middle, then his blessings flow into all of my life. So God is like that. If you add him on the end, he's transforming nothing. Put him in the centre and he's transforming everything. So we worship God because he's so wonderful and yet with us. We worship him because he's important to us. He's at the centre of our life and we want to ascribe him worth. How then can we express our worship? There's an interesting question. There's an infinite way, number of ways to worship God, just as varied as we are from each other. And worship is certainly not just about singing hymns and songs. Worship is ascribing worth to God, showing love and awe and contrition and amazement and so many other emotions beside. But a constant that links all forms of acceptable worship is it puts God ahead of us, above us, infinitely better than us. And that means in some way or other, again, everyone's different, but in some way or other, our worship is extreme. It may be singing with all our heart. It may be silent, lost in wonder, love and praise at the stars or a sunset or a new baby. It may be prostrating ourselves before our holy and awesome God. In Mary's case, as we heard, it was about pouring out all her money and all her affection and ignoring normal protocols. For King David, that we heard about in our first reading, worship meant stripping off his kingly robes in the presence of the King of Kings, wearing a simple tunic and dancing with all his might, leaping and dancing, in fact, and making burnt sacrifices, wasting his money, like Mary did, so it seemed. King David's worship was extravagant, outrageous, and undignified. And again, God approved of it. And his wife despised him. I think it's very interesting indeed that Saul's wife, Michal, despised David for his unseemly, undignified, wholehearted worship. I think that seeing someone else who is sold out for God is a great divider. Either inspires you and makes you too want to worship God, or it repels you because it shows you that you've not really got God at the centre of your life, and seeing someone who has makes you feel very uncomfortable. When we feel uncomfortable about how someone else is worshipping, we're often very good at justifying our feelings and suggesting that their worship is not acceptable, it's undignified, it's over the top, it's emotional, it's embarrassing. Just like the diners did when they saw Mary pouring that nard over Jesus' feet, wiping off with her hair. Just like Michal did when she saw David dancing. But what is clear in both passages is that God himself is really pleased with their extravagant worship. God blesses those who really put him at the centre in whatever way, and he doesn't bless those who criticise from the sidelines. I stand before you this morning and sadly I can't really and truly claim to have God at the very centre of my life. So there are times when I see those who have put God first and it makes me feel uncomfortable. But there are other times when I see true worship in other people and it inspires me and makes me want to get God nearer to the centre of my own life too. So how could I express my worship? How could I show that God is more important than other things in my life? I really love champagne. I've got a lot of empty bottles at home. But if I were to buy a new bottle, like this one, brought it to church and undid it. Challenge here.
Whoa.
If I took my bottle of champagne that I love to drink and I poured it out before the Lord as a fragrant offering to show that I loved him, that would be a nice smell. But also, I'd be saying in that gesture, do you know what, Lord? You're more important to me than that drink or any of the other treats in my life. If I was to come down now and turn around and look at that stained glass window of Jesus on the cross, and I was to be overwhelmed by that, as I think many of us are, and I wanted to prostrate myself on the floor, then that could be showing that I know that God is so bigger than I am, and that I just want to show my worship in my littleness. Maybe like Mary, I wanted to buy some perfume. And this one is a squirty one, not a poury one. But I could go round and again, fragrance, God's holy place, to show that he's more important, he's precious. I'm giving him worth, not myself. Not spraying it on myself, I'm spraying it to God. Or maybe I could sing with all my heart, or raise my arms in worship with a flag, and reach up towards God to show that my praises are going up towards him. There are so many things that I can do in worship. If I didn't have a family, maybe I could enter a religious order. Maybe I could become a nun. Maybe I could go into a closed order and spend my life praying and reading and with my fellow sisters. Would people think that was a waste of my life, my talents, or would they think that I was worshipping God? Do you know what? None of those things prove that I'm in the least bit holy. None of them may be true worship. As I said earlier, God is most interested in a humble and contrite spirit. And you can't see that from the outside, whatever I do. So here's my little summary of worship. You can't worship God too extravagantly. You can't outgive him. You won't lose out. You can always give. You can't give too much. Secondly, you need to put God at the centre to worship him fully. We can only give him the worth that he's got in our lives. Thirdly, if you find someone else's worship acts unacceptable, whatever it is, maybe God's not at the centre of your life. And finally, God is pleased with genuine, extravagant, outrageous and undignified worship. My message to myself this morning is to try and put God nearer the centre of my life and then let's go worship him together. Amen.